Hello, everyone. My name's Chris Walcott. I'm the Chief Trust Officer for Perkins Coie Trust Company. First and foremost, we hope that everyone listening is healthy and safe during these extraordinary times. Over the next 30 minutes, Andrew Ellefson, the Chief Investment Officer for Perkins Coie Trust Company, will be providing our perspective and insights on the economy and markets. Included in this is a little a short Q&A period to answer any questions that you may have. To be able to share a question, please, if you haven't already, in the emails that have gone out, there's an email account to send any questions you might have. You can send questions to PCTCinvestments@perkinscoie.com. With many joining over the phone, this will be more of a podcast format. There won't be any slides accompanying Andrew's presentation. This call is being recorded, as you heard, so we will actually be following up, sending out a link to everyone. So if you'd like to hear this again, that will be provided to you. With that, I will turn it over to Andrew, who will share. Andrew, take it away.
Thanks, Chris, and thank you all for joining us today. As Chris said, our thoughts are with the frontline workers and the essential workforce who are doing all they can to keep us healthy and supplied and groceries and whatnot. We also want to send our thoughts out to those afflicted with the virus and those who are suffering economic hardships. This virus is really hitting many people close to home. In fact, I have a few furloughed family members currently and two relatives who have contracted COVID-19. Fortunately, they're currently asymptomatic, but this is really touching many parts of the country, and most people are being affected in some way. So our thoughts go out to all those folks. As we enter day 62 in quarantine, I also want to thank everyone listening who has done their best to socially distance, to wear masks, to wash your hands, and just generally to take care of each other. The vast majority of people are coming together for the common good, and it's really been amazing to see the response from our communities. So thank you all. With that, our last call was on March 16th, and it has been an absolute wild ride since that day. At that time, we spoke of, the uncertainty and fear that was very pervasive in the markets. It was nearly at a peak when we hosted that call. And at that point, the S&P 500 had fallen nearly 30%. On that call, we discussed the need to stay fully invested, to not panic, and to continuously rebalance for long-term investment results. Over the week after that call, the markets bottomed out and then rallied about 31%, which is one of the strongest market performances in history. So, while this event is certainly unprecedented, it is worth reminding everyone listening here today, all the investors that we work with, that the right strategy every time through every market environment historically has been to have an investment plan and to stick to it. I know I sound like a broken clock now, but I can't stress this enough. It is nearly impossible to get timing the market right. You have to get both the selling time and the buying time right to avoid setting back your investment goals permanently. My mentor used to say that it's time in the markets, not timing the market. So, again, I urge everyone to stay fully invested and stick to your investment plan. With that, the agenda today is to have a brief discussion of our thoughts on both the virus and the economy and their impacts on the markets. So, we'll start with a quick discussion of the virus itself. And I'm happy to report that most regions in the U.S. have now managed to flatten the curve sufficiently through social distancing and economic closure, that we've really avoided sort of the tragic impact that some of the early victims of the virus, such as China, Iran, and Italy, suffered, where they vastly outpaced their hospital capacities and really had a sort of tragic outcome from those numbers. We really have prevented the explosive spread that some other countries have seen. But while still tragic, the efforts of the impacted communities really did limit the human toll of the initial wave of infection. So, We're in no way in the clear, but we are now in a position that we can have discussions about what reopening the economy looks like and how to go about that process in phases. I do want to emphasize that reopening and recovering are two different things. And we'll circle back on that point, but I do expect we will see setbacks in our progress of reopening the economy. All of the major economies that have tried to open have experienced increases in their infection rates and experienced setbacks. So I fully do expect that to be the same case in the US. We still need more tests, we need more tracking, and we need more tracing to have a successful reopening. And people need to continue to take appropriate social distancing and sanitation measures. As I said, I do think we'll probably experience a second wave, but it shouldn't at this point shouldn't exceed our hospital capacity. I also think there'll probably be a second wave of economic impacts, and we'll discuss that a little further on this discussion. But this doesn't need to be a choice between endless lockdowns or reckless reopening. There is a safer middle path with consistent nationwide ability to detect the spread of the virus, to test people, to trace where those infections happened, and to quarantine in a very targeted fashion. We don't have to make the choice between protecting health and protecting the economy. Unfortunately, the federal plan is not well fleshed out. States will ultimately be the laboratories that sort of experiment with what the right mix is of how to reopen and how quickly to let people return to a more normalized environment. And as with investing, there is a trade-off between risk and return here. We don't yet know what the right pace of reopening looks like, but by the end of May, 95% of states will have begun reopening their economies. So in the next few weeks, we will have a lot more data and we'll know very soon what works and what doesn't work. And ideally, best practices will be shared among states' governors and various regions that are afflicted. So what does this mean for the economy? What does reopening look like for our economy? As of this morning, we had an additional 3 million people now seeking unemployment benefits. That total now stands at 36.5 million applications for unemployment benefits and 22.8 million people receiving benefits since the virus began shutting down businesses in mid-March. That's nearly 16% of the entire eligible labor force out there. Not only that, 50% of all households are reporting income and wealth loss, according to the National Bureau of Economic Research. And 8 million people have exited the workforce entirely as of the beginning of this pandemic. Those are folks who basically think they are not going to get a job again, whether due to early retirement or just inability to match skills to available jobs. So this really is recasting our entire economy at this point. It is estimated that 75% of all job losses are temporary. So that's really where our team and economists everywhere are looking for the improvement in the coming months, as that 75% of people do return to work. As we said earlier, reopening and recovery are two different things. Reopening the economy doesn't mean that your consumers show up. People need to feel confident that they can return to work, restaurants, and return to shopping as well. So this still does require a medical solution to this virus. Can't just have an economic. So we do expect a prolonged period of low economic activity. Currently, the consensus forecast of economists across the US is for the GDP this year to be down 4.6%. And while that number sounds horrific, I do want to remind everyone listening that that means we still have $21 trillion in economic activity in this country, even if that current negative 4.6% number is true. So while it may feel like the world is ground to a halt, I do, I emphasize that the economy keeps running and it keeps producing economic goods. So when economists talk about a recovery, what they're really talking about is a return to full employment and a resumption of GDP growth. So the question is, when does that appear? And the best estimates at this point, and the growing consensus from economists, is that we don't return to a full employment situation and a growth economy until 2022. So reopening really is the first step on a long path to recovery. So with that outlook, your question would probably be, why should I continue to invest? And so let's turn our attention to markets at this point. Many of you have heard me say, and I'm sure I said it on the last call, that the market is not the economy and the economy is not the market. They can operate very independently of each other. The market is very forward-looking. It discounts what is yet to come, not what just happened. And economics tends to look at what just happened. So at our last call, we were in the middle of essentially the market digesting the worst of the expectations for the future. We really were in the thick of the fear and anxiety cycle of this market. Today, the market is trying to weigh what the probabilities of a recovery look like and how that happens, when it happens, and what the impacts of that are. So really the market move you've seen in April is investors grappling with the long term. And you'll hear us around PCTC say, you know, we're long-term investors, so we're grappling with the same issues. Support for a market reopening really well, and the support for the markets performing as they have done has really come from three areas and will continue to come from three areas. A, we have a medical response. B is monetary response, and C is a fiscal response. So let's address those in order. There will be a medical response at some point that is a white swan event that essentially surprises everyone, right? We've all heard the prognostications about a vaccine coming to markets. I think current optimistic thinking is 12 to 18 months. I would emphasize that there are more resources being thrown at this virus than almost any virus in history, outside of perhaps the AIDS epidemic, and it's really been a phenomenal effort by the healthcare system. So, you know, there will be a white swan event that will surprise the markets and will cause some reason for celebration and optimistic markets again. There could also be a therapy that is developed that effectively neutralizes the fatality of the virus. And I want to emphasize this is a therapy, not a cure. We had a drug from Gilead that was approved for emergency use recently that seems to have some impact at the margin on the lethality of the virus. So as doctors pursue solutions to this, we will see more and more of those events coming to market. Second is a monetary response that has propped up the markets and really provided a backstop to the crisis environment we had in March. The Federal Reserve, which is in charge of the U.S. monetary response, learned a lot of lessons from the 2008 crisis. In 2008, it took them some time to get up and running and really moving swiftly, but they really did learn what worked well and what didn't work well in that environment. And so when this crisis arose, they were one of the fastest moving institutions and really took measures that prevented a liquidity crisis from becoming a credit crisis. And that's really key because that liquidity crisis are short-term events that can be transitory, but credit crisis can be permanent economic damage. So I give a lot of credit to the Federal Reserve. Some of the policies they implemented, they dropped rates very rapidly to near zero. They massively expanded their quantitative easing program. They expanded not only the amount they're purchasing, but what they are willing to purchase. They started purchasing mortgage-backed securities and corporate debt, and even have begun purchasing ETFs for the first time in history. So really backstopping quite a few asset classes. They opened primary dealer facilities. They opened repo operations. They began lending directly to banks, municipalities, and large employers, and they relaxed regulations. So, really, just everywhere they could act, they did. And so, we've had a phenomenal response from that. And I actually give them a lot of credit for why the markets were able to recover from those March lows. It is worth mentioning that the Federal Reserve is now buying almost two times the amount that the U.S. Treasury is issuing. We actually have a shrinking treasury market in terms of what's available to investors. That creates what's essentially known as a crowding out effect. If you would have been a treasury investor, you may not find those yields attractive enough to invest in any longer and will be crowded out into other asset classes, so U.S. corporate debt or municipal debt or even into equities. So some people will call this the TINA effect, the TINA, there is no alternative. essentially forcing investors out the risk spectrum. So that could account for some of the performance we've seen in April. But essentially, if you're going to buy a treasury, you are up against a price insensitive buyer. The Federal Reserve is going to buy treasuries no matter what the price is. So just keep that in mind as we. Monetary policy has a powerful and persistent impact on markets and asset prices, and has really been one of the leading factors in this equity recovery. The fiscal response is also very key to an economic recovery and certainly the market performance. The fiscal response is really meant to prop up ailing businesses and households until we can reopen. So it's essentially backstopping the economy when the economy can't help itself. The CARES Act, which was about just over $2 trillion, was clumsy. It was poorly executed, but it was absolutely necessary and reasonably swiftly implemented. We now have additional stimulus being proposed this week for additional funds being paid out to consumers and small businesses. There are arguments being made at the moment that we maybe can't afford more stimulus or that the deficit is growing too high. But stimulus at this point is to prevent that temporary economic damage from the virus from becoming permanent economic damage where companies simply close and have no possibility of recovery. And that's the key here. People have to be able to come out of this. And the longer it goes on, the harder it is going to be to climb out of this mess. So if they can provide some sort of backstop, to the economic impact, that will have very positive returns over time. I would even argue, or could argue, that fiscal stimulus today may have one of the highest rates of return in the U.S. After maybe the freeway system. Just to, if you can prevent permanent economic damage from happening, and if we get this right. So one last comment on the markets. Markets are composed of companies. Sometimes we talk about markets as if they're a nebulous, just the S&P 500. But really, what's underlying that are companies and sectors and people running those companies making decisions. And companies are having wildly different experiences during this pandemic. I 6 months ago, I would wager most people on this call couldn't have told you what Zoom was. But I believe I have at least two Zoom conferences going on upstairs currently. That stock is up 143% this year and has become an absolutely indispensable technology to many people. Companies like Microsoft have had a phenomenal performance as their cloud infrastructure provides the backbone to the working from home component of our economy at this point. So, there are parts of the economy that are doing very well. Meanwhile, there have been absolute casualties of this crisis. Top of my head, J.Crew, Neiman Marcus, Hertz, or JCPenney are unlikely to survive this downturn. And the one thing all of those companies had in common is that they had lots of debt on their balance sheet, unsustainable amounts of debt, in a world that required them to do a lot of spending to continue to compete. Other companies that are being impacted, there's a whole group of companies that are being impacted through essentially no fault of their own. They had good financial standing coming into this crisis, but they have what are generally referred to as stranded assets. So assets that can't earn a return. So think about airlines or hotels or cruise ships. These are big, expensive assets they're still paying leases on that can't generate any revenue. So those companies generally will be considered for bailouts. They are systemically important to an economy, with the exception of cruise ships, perhaps. So our team listens to a lot of company earnings calls. We talk with a lot of analysts. Wall Street. We speak with a lot of senior managements at companies. And while uncertainty prevails at the moment, we do have confidence that certainly in our portfolio, our processes and our investments are fairly secure. We have re reviewed the balance sheets of the companies we like to invest in. We've reviewed the cash flow positions of these companies. Generally, PCTC focuses on very high quality companies with very sustainable franchises that are built to weather all types of economic horizons. Again, that focus on long-term investing tends to pay off in events like this. So many of these good companies will actually come out of this crisis with less or weaker competition, and with more resilient business practices and with lower cost structures. So, a lot of companies are implementing automation. A lot of companies are creating redundant supply chains and moving it out of sole supply chains in one region, China in particular. Many companies, including Perkins Coie, have really implemented work from home as a sustainable process for part of their workforce, and it will be a bigger component going forward, which reduces overall costs for real estate certainly and employee expenses. And generally, I think we probably are in for a world of less commercial real estate if companies continue to implement work from home. And real estate tends to be the second largest line item in most companies' budgets. So, crisis often builds the foundation of the future for very good companies. So, those are the types of companies we're looking for who are going to weather this and come out stronger on the other end. We've covered a lot of material, and I want to summarize here and leave some time for Q&A. But essentially, people are using the word unprecedented quite a lot these days. But it's absolutely right. This is new territory for all of us. There are no models for how this looks or how this proceeds. But I do want to remind everyone on this call, this virus is a finite event. This is not a permanent fixture of our existence. And the economic downturn is a transitory event. And the market is a future probability discounting machine. So it is looking through the finality of the virus and the downturn. So in other words, we will see better days. We will be released from our isolation, and we will begin to rebuild our economy. So I do strongly believe in the capacity of our country to rise up to challenges like this. We have in every circumstance in the past, and I believe we will again. So in closing, as always, I want to encourage everyone listening here to have an investment plan and stick to it. To stay fully invested through the cycles, and continue to wash your hands, of course. So we look forward to seeing all of you in the not too distant future, hopefully at a live in-person meeting, and not over these video calls anymore. So with that, I'm going to turn it back to Chris. We will open it up for a Q&A session. And as he reminded you at the beginning of the call, the email address is on the screen there, but it is pctcinvestments@perkinscoie.com if you have any questions you'd like us to answer.
Thank you, Andrew. And we do have a handful of questions already, so I'll jump into them. First question would be, what if there is a second wave of infection? Do you see us shutting down the economy again?
I would say there's a very high probability of a second wave of infection at some point. Most of the economies that have tried to open up have seen an increase in their infection rate. The key is to keep that infection rate below the capacity, the hospital capacity. I strongly don't believe we will have to shut down the economy again. The shutdown was really buying us time. From when this was essentially an explosive infection rate, where people weren't social distancing, they weren't, taking good precautions with washing hands and being cautious around other folks who are sick. They weren't wearing masks. And the shutdown bought us time to implement a lot of those practices, to get our hospital capacities up, and to be in a position to deal with sort of a sustained level of infection. But hopefully not a massively growing level of infection. And as long as people continue to use those practices, I don't believe we'll have to fully shut down our economy again. That doesn't mean it's a linear line to a full open. We will have fits and starts, but I believe we are or past the depths of the closed economy at this point.
You had mentioned just staying fully invested. One of the questions is, what is, do you have generally an idea of what the impact is of being out of the market?
Yes, I have a few thoughts on that. I would say, first and foremost is you never know what the future holds for market returns. And I would highlight, a week after our last call that the markets began rallying for 31%. I could not have told you on that call that that would happen. So market timing always has costs associated with it. But in the meantime, I would also say that the vast majority of the companies that we are invested in continue to pay their dividends. And obviously, the bonds continue to pay their coupons. And so, you know, the dividend yield at this point has actually crept up fairly steadily. It's paying close to 2.5, 3%, if I'm not mistaken. I'd have to check my numbers on the S&P 500. But, you know, cash at this point is yielding next to nothing. The money market fund, one of the biggest money market funds in the US, yields about 0.14% currently. So the differential between that and a dividend from a Microsoft or a Starbucks is going to be about 2% every year, with that option that you are going to miss out on any upside market performance when we do eventually have a full recovery.
You mentioned yields. Is it, with the yields so low, why should I own bonds? Is one of the questions.
Yeah, that's a great question because we actually have a lot of data around that from a number of countries around the world who have had near zero interest rates for quite a few years. First and foremost, I would say, you know, there is not a lot of compelling reason to own US treasuries at this point. They don't yield almost anything. I'd have to check my numbers this morning, but you know, it's less than definitely less than 1%. It's about 1%, 1.3% on a 30-year bond. But that doesn't mean every bond doesn't have yield. So we invest in a Ginnie Mae fund, which is still yielding well over 2.5%. And those are backed by the full faith and credit of the US government. But you're picking up that spread on being part of the mortgage market, which is still fairly attractive. There's still a lot of housing activity going on. Corporate debt also still has quite an attractive yield. So one of the first impacts in March was that the spreads on corporate debt really blew out as people didn't know which companies would be able to pay back their debt or not. It impacted all companies equally and really hasn't retraced all the way back down to the expensive prices you were seeing on bonds at the beginning of this year. So, you know, while I agree with the sentiment that bonds don't yield much, they do still play a role in portfolios. First and foremost is principal protection. And then there is that steady income. While it's not as high as it used to be historically, there is still portions of the market that have a healthy income.
You mentioned commercial real estate. What is the impact of COVID on real estate and REITs so far?
Yeah, that's a great question as well. This is personal opinion, and I have no data to support it at this point, but I do believe that the commercial real estate market is probably going to be challenged over the next few years, both from the stance that they're going to lose tenants who just go out of business, but also from this effort to have people work from home and reduce their footprint of needs in commercial real estate. In fact, I actually had a conference call with the CFO of a very large commercial real estate company this morning, and they were saying that only 64% of their tenants had paid rent in April. So that was a little bit eye-opening. That said, we tend to invest in some very niche parts of the real estate market in our portfolios. So one of the names you'll see in our portfolios is American Tower, which is cell towers and the land underneath them, which are having a heyday currently as everybody is consuming as much data as humanly possible at the moment. That company's had an extraordinary year. And then we use a real estate fund for part of our alternatives investments. And you know, that's investing in all aspects of real estate from you know mortgage-backed securities through commercial real estate, residential real estate, and industrial real estate. But also things like server data centers, you know, Microsoft and Google and Facebook and all these folks don't like to spend their capital directly on the buildings and infrastructure and the land underneath it. And so real estate investment trusts have had a really healthy business creating those real estate transactions and financing that those land purchases. And those provide a really strong yield to portfolios. They're still indicating a yield of about 5.5% to portfolios. So while I have my concerns in parts of the real estate economy, generally, I think it's a really interesting asset class going forward. It's also real assets in the ground, which tend to hold their value fairly well. So it could be an interesting opportunity going forward.
I think most of us on this call thought going into 2020, one of the major unknowns that could impact the market would be November elections. Obviously, that's been so far out of our minds with everything going on currently. But the question is asking, with everything I guess going on now, how does November and the elections potentially impact things?
That's also a very good question. Historically, and remember, we're in unprecedented times, but historically, the elections have a very short-term impact on market returns. You see sort of an immediate reaction as people try and sort out what it means, what the new policies will be. But if you go out even just a month to 3 months beyond the election, generally it's hard to identify the lasting impact of an election on returns. With the caveat that some sectors can be hurt more than others. So last year, when Elizabeth Warren was surging in the polls, healthcare really did have a tough quarter. As she receded in the polls, healthcare came back a little bit. Parts of healthcare are having a tremendous year this year. Other parts are having a difficult year, but it's that expectation around policy. And so I don't think it's so much who gets the presidency as it is, if Congress goes all one party or the other and the policies that they were likely to enact. I'm not sure I can prognosticate much beyond that. I do think it's worth mentioning, Donald Trump looked in all polling data like he was a shoo-in before coronavirus. Now polling data is essentially saying that he's certainly at risk, if not the Senate is currently at risk as well for turning Democrat. That would create a executive and legislative branch that were all in the same party, which historically has produced a lot more change in regulatory environments and the laws that are passed, and so that can have a slightly larger impact than just a presidential election.
Well, we've just passed kind of the 30-minute mark, and kind of wraps up most of the questions here. If we haven't gotten to questions that people have, we're here to answer those questions. We're open to having a one-on-one conversation with you as well. We're here to serve you, and if there's anything that we can be doing to assist, we hope that you would reach out to us. During this time, we want to stay more connected with our clients, and this is just part of that. And so, with that, I just want to thank you for joining us. And Andrew, thank you for sharing. And we will bring this call to a close. So, thank you, everybody, and have a great day.